All right, guys. We're going to get started. I don't have any handouts today because the copier is out of ink. Dad, would you mind starting us off with a word of prayer, and then we'll get going.
Most gracious Heavenly Father, we bow before you at this time, thanking you for all the wonderful blessings of life and asking, dear Father, for your wisdom and guidance, and that you direct that wisdom to us as we make decisions for the church here at Westside. We pray, dear Father, that we would be mindful always of the principles that you have established for us, and that they might dictate our responses to our needs and the direction this congregation will go. It is our prayer that in all things you will be pleased and that you will help us in this. And we ask it in your Son's name. Amen.
Amen. All right. So first on the agenda, the finances. So last month, we talked a little bit about the budget, and I handed out a sheet. Like I said, I don't have copies. Sorry about that. And asked you to, think about that, and we'll make some final decisions this month. Really, all I want to focus on are the changes that I had mentioned last month as a possibility in the budget, because a lot of it's set, like the electric bill and the internet bill and, that type of stuff. But the one thing that we talked about changing was getting rid of the camera monitoring service, because it's $200 a month, and it's something that really they don't do a great job of it. It's not very efficient, and it's something that we can do ourselves for a lot cheaper. We still, of course, have that. That's not the security system itself. That's just the service to monitor the cameras. Does anybody have an objection to getting rid of that and doing that ourselves? Okay, so we will then work on canceling that service as soon as possible to save that $200 a month. The other thing was the benevolence to set aside. And what I had suggested was setting aside just $500 a month, and then as it's needed, we would use it. And once we exceed that $500, and I'm not saying, that's $6,000 a year, okay? So once we exceed that $6,000 a year, then we can, have some discussions. Obviously, if there is a need that arises, like, for example, last week, there might be some Christians that really need some help that we're not aware of right now, or that you may be aware of, and that's something that we can always discuss and give more. But that's kind of a set thing to where we've got that money set aside. That way, if a need does arise, then we can quickly discuss, hey, this needs arises. We've got this money set aside. Let's go ahead and do it, just to kind of streamline that process. So is everybody okay? Are there any objections to setting that amount per month to just kind of as a starting point? Okay. And then the other thing that we mentioned was I mentioned Dad's salary, and I put on there just so y'all were aware that he's made the same since 2015. And the reason I bring it up is I did have two men that suggested an increase. One gave a specific number, one didn't. And so I kind of leave that to y'all to take from here. That's the information, because, again, that kind of puts me in an awkward spot talking about the whether or not, and if so, how much to give my dad a raise. But what are your thoughts on that? The reason I bring it up at all is because it was suggested by a couple of men that gave me some feedback on that budget that I put out last month.
We do have the capability, yes?
I believe so. We have the with that handout from last month and all the lists, we have an excess of right at $2,700 a month is what our surplus is right now based on this budget. And that's the other thing I did when I went through. One suggestion, I kind of basically rounded everything up to the nearest 100 instead of being so specific. That way we've got just a little bit of, to play with, because, the electric bill like this past week was a lot higher than other weeks. But yeah, $2,700 a month is what we have in surplus. Yes, Ian.
What was the suggested amount?
The suggested amount.
And I gave you the paper.
I know, and then I forgot to write. It was the suggested amount increase. The one that was suggested was right at 600 increase a month is what was suggested.
I was between $500 to $1,000 increase a month.
thing. Again, I don't.
I mean, I basically based it on inflation from 15 to 21 and upped it a little bit from there.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking, the cost of living increase from between 2015 and now would be about $600 a month. So, I guess this is again, this is just awkward for me. does anybody just go ahead?
Motion for 600.
Hey, motion for 600. Anybody second that? Any objections to that 600 a month increase? All right, then that will start in a couple weeks with his March paycheck.
Thank you for your generosity, brother.
Thank you for your work.
And the only other thing, since we're on the budget, with we had a baptism, of course, a couple weeks ago. So great for that. And one thing that we realized is how outdated our baptismal attire is, if you will. There are a bunch of basically the same size stuff. They're white, which I don't understand why they got white anyway. Because
well, that's way better.
Yeah. Does anybody have, or my motion is to spend a little bit to update that. Get different sizes, get some, you know, make sure there's enough for the, you know, some women's stuff as well, because all there is a bunch of whitey tidies in there for, you know, from the 60s, I guess. And so.
No female undergarments.
Yeah, no female undergarments. So I really don't have an idea of a price for that, but. It's a need that needs to be filled. Does anybody object to purchasing those things? Okay. And so, tell you what, we'll look into that and then get a price and we'll and next meeting. Because my wife said she had already been looking at some stuff, and because I really have no clue. I mean, I don't know if 100, 200 bucks would be enough, or we're going to need 300 or 400 to get enough. I really don't know. So I will have her look into that, get some prices. And then we can discuss that quickly next week. But that's all that I have as far as the finances are concerned. Are there any questions or suggestions about that? I saw you first, Josh.
Did we talk about loan?
No, we didn't.
Okay, so March is...
Yeah, it's coming up.
Everything I looked at over the wintertime was between, like, that would handle what we have back there is going to be between $2,500 to $3,000. If that's an okay amount, my plan is to get it from Lowe's and use my 10% discount, and then also we'll get the church's tax ID number. So we'll save 10% plus we won't pay tax on it on that route. If anybody has objections to that price range, otherwise I'll just handle it in the next month.
Okay. Any objections to the $2,500 to $3,000 price range to get the new riding lawnmower that we need here about a month from now? All right. Justin.
Follow on that real quick. Does anybody want, or do we have a plan for, because we've got to get rid of the other one? I don't know if anybody is interested in having to take it. I don't think we need to sell it. The motor's.
Well, I don't think we're going to get anything for it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I wasn't planning on that. But if there's anybody that's interested in having it.
Yeah. If anybody wants to work on a lawnmower or use it for spare parts, you know. It's there. If not, we'll work on getting rid of it.
No worries.
Yes, Justin.
I was gonna say, can we just say that, you know, we're assuming that for the baptismal linens, we're talking like four different sizes probably, yeah. And can we just set a number and say if they can find it and it's under 400, go ahead and do it. If it's more, then bring the number back.
That's fine with me.
We've got a couple of sizes in those surgical scrubs, which has really worked well, especially the dark colors. So for the women, we've got several sizes. I don't know that we got maybe one in the men's, but if we just do those scrubs and extra, we really need one extra large.
Yeah.
Then extra large, medium at the very least. And I think we've got the smalls for the women, but mediums will work. So
when we say... What about 300? Because if we got some size. So anybody object to saying $300 for the baptismal linens?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll let my wife know that, and like I said, she's already been looking. And we'll get that taken care of. Do you have something, Ian?
No.
Okay. All right, moving on. And this is a quick one before we get into what finish up what we started last month. Preaching request. So Ian made me aware that Michael Baker, he was actually here for the singing last night. Several of y'all know him. He's wanting to get back into preaching. He did it for a while, he's had some personal issues he's been dealing with, and he's past that, and so he's wanting to get back into it, and he's wanting opportunities to preach. And so Ian made that request known. Not necessarily, so what you know, my suggestion is not necessarily a gospel meeting, not to that extent yet, and we've got our gospel meetings planned out. But I'm thinking some, you know, Sunday have him come, and he could take the class, and both sermons one Sunday in the future, and that would give him an opportunity to preach and to, you know, bring him in, give him that experience, let us listen to somebody else besides that guy, and, you know, everybody wins. Yes, Josh.
Everybody wins.
He's up in Blair Mill, and he's right out
10. Yeah,
West Main.
He's a 10
Westman. Would he be willing to commit to like maybe one Sunday a month coming in, and that way he can get some like? Yeah. I don't know how.
Well, I don't think we should do that because.
Well, I meant just one service one Sunday, not both sermons.
Both sermons.
It's whatever.
I just don't want to take away from our guys doing it. Especially since you told me you're planning on getting one. That's an idea. And we can, you know, and we can talk about that later in the future. I think for now it'd be good just to set one, you know, pick one Sunday.
The first question is whether or not anybody's opposed to
it. Yeah, is anybody opposed to having Michael come and preach? We had actually scheduled him for a meeting a while back, and it fell through. But anybody opposed to Michael coming and preaching? Okay.
What's the purpose?
To help him get some experience and to have a chance. He doesn't have a chance to really get in the pulpit, from what I understand, where he's going, because they're limiting their services still, and he's just wanting to get the, you know, have the opportunity to preach somewhere.
So is he looking at, like, you know, congregations around or places we send people occasionally to help? Is he looking for that too?
Yeah. I'm sure he would take that, yeah. Yeah, he's, and so that's something as well.
He's feeling preaching for right now, but he's, I think he eventually wants to get back full-time work again.
He does.
Yeah. But he's also a talented speaker and a good man, so.
Okay. So as far as the date, does anybody have an objection to Dad and Ian kind of working with Michael to figure out a date in the future, and then we will, you know, let them in know about that? No objections to that?
Start off with one and then
right.
Work it out.
Yeah, well, one Sunday, and then, if, you know, we can go from there. And hopefully he'll be able to find other places too. And that's one thing to keep in mind. If you hear about a group that needs a fill-in preacher, you know, he's one man to think of that would do a good job there.
So should we share his contact information in case we do hear something?
I'm sure that would be appropriate. I'll let Ian take care of that since Ian's been talking to him.
You've already mentioned though to him, he's mentioned you, that if you know sons they will take him.
Yes,
right. So yeah. Yeah, I think he's already given permission for that. So
for
we
that.
Just need to
I'll
get
put it
that.
On the Facebook page.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that gets us to continuing the discussion from last month that Dennis started. And I mentioned the four questions. I mean, and the questions are really decisions. And I'll read them again. The first one we did agree on, we did conclude, it was discuss whether we are still in agreement as the decision made last March. And if I misspeak, Dennis, let me know. But that decision about not to be judgmental about anybody for their decisions on, you know, whether to come or not to come to services based on their situation in the coronavirus pandemic and the virus. And so we did decide we're still in agreement that we're not going to be judgmental. in that areas. And we said judgmental as far as judging a brother, judging that a brother's in sin because they're choosing not to. We specifically talked about that judgment being a judgment of sin, that a brother is not doing right by choosing their choice of how to handle that in their situation as far as the virus and the pandemic is concerned. The second one was discuss whether we should allow such remarks from the pulpit. Okay, remarks, judgmental remarks from the pulpit in the future about that virus and about the handling of it. Third, if not, decide how to handle any future occurrence contrary to this decision. And then the fourth being agreed to bring this and similar matters before the men, before bringing them before the congregation. And so the second of those, discuss whether we should allow such remarks from the pulpit in the future. And so I will open it up to anybody that wants to make a point as far as that's concerned. Go ahead, Justin.
Oh, I think such remarks is a little vague, but I think where we were talking last time is that it's always appropriate for us to examine ourselves. And so a call for people to examine themselves is always appropriate. And the thing that I brought up last time is just the being careful about not moving to another level, you know, where that's not what you're doing, where you're judging something that you don't have the capability of judging,
right?
Judging the internals of a person. And then the other is just not beating a topic to death. And that goes for anything, right? The like two classic examples of that is, you know, a preacher preaches on the same topic every single month, right? So it's one of their 9-ish so sermons a month. And they preach it every month. And it's like, well, there are more than 9 topics in the Bible. How do you keep coming back to this every month? And it may be that they think it's a major weakness of the congregation and they think it's appropriate to preach it that often. But there are other cases, and we've all seen this, where somebody has a pet topic and it doesn't even matter what you're studying in a Bible class. They bring up that topic every single Bible class.
Right.
And you're like, well, wait a minute. We were talking about the Lord's Supper, and you brought up this thing that has nothing to do with the Lord's Supper. And then the next week, we were talking about prayer, and you brought up this thing that had nothing to do with prayer. You know, you're detracting from the efficacy of the class. And so my position has been to encourage everyone to be mindful of all of those things. And then if somebody thinks that somebody isn't being mindful of those things, then go to the person and talk to them about it. So, I don't know if anyone thinks that we need more than that. Just one more thing. Because people say things by accident that end up sounding harsher than they really are.
Right.
There have been a couple of times that people have said from the pulpit that people staying home were wrong. And they didn't mean it. Right? You just can't stand in the pulpit and talk that much without accidentally saying something that's a little off.
Right.
I mean, Stan said this morning that Joseph was writing something there at the end of Joshua, right?
Joseph
wasn't even there. But he didn't mean to say that. And so I think just some phrasing that's not even wrong, just people are hearing it different ways, and it's affecting, you know, those kind of misunderstandings going one-on-one. And if it turns out not to be a misunderstanding, the person meant to say that to the extent they did, then again, it's just a discussion that needs to be had.
Anybody else? Well, I'll just ask you, Dennis, since you asked that question and wanted to bring up the discussion. Do you have anything to add, or is that?
Well, I guess what comes down to is, chief, questioner, or judge, either person's decision, either to not wear a mask, even if at all, or to stay home, then it gets to be problematic when we get in the pulpit and teach or critique or question or judge that very question. We've already agreed not to do it. So my question there was, under what conditions should we address the subject of how and why we should object? We should definitely encourage someone to not take this as an advantage to sin. I can see us doing that. But on the other hand, we don't want to put a stumbling block before someone who is genuinely staying home because or for the right reasons. The problem is we don't know what their reasons are because we have decided not to go and question them. We haven't put the question to everyone in the congregation, you know, why aren't you wearing a mask? Why aren't you staying at home? And there's a good reason for that, I think. After this is all over, we may revisit this whole subject and decide maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. We could repent of it. But right now, we're hoping the Lord understands we're doing the best we can under the situation. Does that make sense?
It does. And so what I'm hearing is...
When you get in the pulpit and you start questioning the other side, that hurts. It causes them to doubt themselves and makes them think that you really don't care about how they feel. We don't want that going on because we know that's not true. We know we love each other.
Sure.
And the reason why someone may be motivated to speak in the pulpit is because of that love. They want the other person to be okay with God.
And so what I'm hearing...
Leave that alone for now.
Right. And so what I'm hearing is if you do have an issue with how somebody is handling their situation, talk to them personally. And don't use the pulpit or the class as...
We can't do that either. So we've already decided we're not going to do that. They have, for lack of a better word, carte blanche for the time being. Both do. We'll deal with it later.
He's saying if somebody gets up there and says something.
No, he's saying if I have problems with you not coming to service, I should go to you and talk to you about it.
Were you talking about that, or were you talking?
Well,
about
I was, but it's not. But again, I say that because we know of individual situations sometimes that are right. Like there are individuals I know of that I think they are putting the board second because of all the things they're going and doing and they're not coming to service, for example.
Okay.
Now, I should go to that person is what I'm saying, not address it in a blanket statement from the pulpit or in class. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying somebody that is, again, that's a unique situation and that's other factors besides they're just not coming. For all I know, they're not coming just because of the virus. And as far as I know, they're doing everything they're supposed to, but they're not coming because of the virus. Yeah, I'm not going to go to them. But if I know for a fact they're doing other things and they're contradicting, and I'm worried about their spiritual, that's the situation I'm talking about. You know, and I think, yeah.
But that's the catch-22 that Dennis just said that we can't do.
I don't know. I don't
judge somebody because of their choices of COVID. No.
He's not saying that, Rick.
That's exactly what he just said.
Well, he misinterpreted or he misspoke because we both just agreed with each other there on what we were saying. Correct? You just agreed with what I said as far as going?
If you have cause and knowledge, it's without knowledge.
The premise before that is that we would not judge a person's actions or directions about COVID. If they're staying home because of COVID, we cannot judge their actions. Period. That's what the premise is. And if that's the premise, then we cannot go to that individual and say, hey, I'm concerned for your soul. Because that would be an act of judgment.
So, a point of clarity. What Josh is bringing up is that he's not going to them because of the decision that they've made about COVID. He's going to them because he sees them apparently being dishonest with themselves.
I agree with that. That is what we have to do as Christians.
I can go to them and say, I'm not trying to be judgmental about your decision about whether or not you're coming to
services. So then how can we say we can't do that from the pulpit? I'm not going to an individual person saying, I believe your actions are wrong, and therefore I'm judging you. I'm imploring somebody to reflect upon their own life and let them make that judgment.
Well, and that's what I said a moment ago, was calling for people to examine themselves is always appropriate. There are questions of doing it all the time can lead to other negative consequences, but there's a difference between saying you need to examine yourself to make sure that you're not letting this be an excuse versus saying you need to examine this because you are letting this be an excuse. You see the difference there? And I personally don't have a problem with the former, and I actually don't have a problem with you bringing it up every single time because you're never going to get on my nerves about it. But I know that other things are like that. Something we brought up before was tact, and something I brought up a moment ago was just the way imprecise speech can be misinterpreted. What Dennis said a second ago is it all coming from love is very, very true. And I've commented on that to people after particular things have been said. It's like, all right, the person said that because they're concerned about a soul. So you should take that. Fact of the matter is, when anyone comes up to one of us and is bringing something, say they're bringing it, you know, with regard to Matthew 18 or whatever in the world, we should readily accept them bringing that and want to examine ourselves because we want to be right with God. And so somebody comes and tells me, you know, Justin, you did thus and such. You need to check yourself. And so I check myself and I get to the end of that and I'm like, I think I'm right. I think I considered everything and I made this decision and I don't think it's wrong. I go back to that person because I want to have a common understanding with them and I talk to them about it, but we might not come to agreement. So when they come to me again with the exact same topic a month later, I don't then reject that out of hand. I yet again examine myself. Hopefully over the course of a month I've gotten wiser. Hopefully over the course of a month I've taken in experiences which might better inform my decision. And maybe I discover I'm wrong that time, or maybe I still don't think I'm wrong. But re-examining ourselves over and over again. A problem that I've had, and I mentioned this last time, is that I have inadvertently really, really hurt people before because I have called on them to examine themselves over and over and over again, and it led them to swing the pendulum too far the other way. And actually to be less good servants of God because they restricted themselves so much, because they did bring themselves under a tighter judgment. And a judgment that possibly was, well, that I believe was inappropriate in the other direction. But it all gets back to the emotion.
Well, here, this may be a act of futility, but to try to simplify, look at it in practical terms. We're sitting here discussing this, and we can't even understand each other here having one-on-one discussions. We're misinterpreting, we're misunderstanding, we're misspeaking, you know, talking about the preciseness of speech, some are more precise than others, and it's causing issues. So what makes us think that we can do that from the pulpit or from as a teacher from, you know, teaching a class and not have that same thing happen? Regardless of whose fault it is, maybe it's more on the listener than the speaker, but regardless, it's still going to cause those problems. Can we teach the full counsel of God without once mentioning the coronavirus from the pulpit? I believe we can. Does anybody disagree with that? So let's just not mention it because it has the potential and has caused issues. We're not telling anybody you can't preach. We're not telling anybody you can't go to somebody if you think that their soul is in jeopardy or they are in sin or their faith is struggling. Even if it's struggling because of the way they're handling this virus, you think that that's legitimate, that they are, their soul is in jeopardy, yes, we can go to them in any circumstance for that. But as far as addressing these things from the pulpit as a congregation, specifically, not with the gospel, but specifically with the application of this coronavirus, because there is so much, again, misunderstanding even between us just talking here, you know, amongst ourselves, much less from the pulpit when there is no direct feedback and clarification, and that, and we got people listening online and that sort of thing. You know, can we just, you know, not comment on that anymore, I think is a way to put it.
So speak things and draw no application?
No. Don't draw this one specific application.
So censorship.
On not this one, yes. Can you preach the gospel, the full counsel, without making, because this is a very controversial, opinionated application.
Can I make a quick point? I think this will help maybe to understand what the initial intent was. It was not an intent to compromise. What we were doing was discussing the proper response when individuals made the decision that they could not come to services for fear, for health fears due to the COVID virus. What do we do in those kinds of situations? It all came down to a discussion of what constitutes forsaking the assembly. And in this application, if an individual has a health issue that makes him vulnerable to the virus, can we in good conscience say that person is forsaking the assembling of ourselves together? And as a congregation at that time, or the men of the congregation in that business meeting, they made the decision, no, we can't say that for certainty. We may have some individual conjecture about it or how it would be with us. We can't put ourselves in the position of the other person and say they're forsaking. We all agree, the individuals who are not coming right now agree that forsaking the assembly is sin. But we were not able to come to the conclusion that any particular individual, for example, if I were to use the Matneys as an example, with their age and their health, them not coming, that they're sinning by not coming. So we made the decision then for individuals who were concerned about their health, if that concern was sufficient for them to say, I can't come. Just like we even made the parallels. The roads are icy. There's a thunderstorm out. The weather is dangerous. Or I've got a fever. All those kinds of things. If it's dangerous for you or you're endangering others to come in that regard, then you're not forsaking the assembly when you don't come in that case. And that's where we left it. And as a result of that, the only thing that we could say is in that situation, if someone's in that situation, then we're not going to judge them in that matter. We're going to leave it to them. If we put it in the realm of Romans 14 in that regard, then you're not supposed to dispute for one another because Romans 14:1 says don't. Okay? So we're not supposed to be trying to talk them out of it if this is a matter of their conscience and conviction, if we can't say it's sin. That's where this has all come from. It has nothing to do with not preaching the whole counsel of God. Nothing to do. It's simply a matter of if you've got a member in the congregation who can't come, feel they cannot come, you're not saying that they can. But then there is a perception left from the pulpit, from them, that you're saying I'm sinning because I'm not there. That is a discouragement. And that's where Dennis came from in that regard. And I can see where that is the case with some comments, whether it was intended or not, that have been made in the past in that regard. So it comes down to it's the same thing. And I would like to emphasize that while we're really disputing all this and having problems with it, it's a moot point anyway, because every single individual, and we have very few of our number that are not here, but every single individual who is not here has stated that they cannot come because of the virus. The exact same thing that we talked about beforehand. That's the reason that they're giving. There is a health situation or circumstance, or it's just age, or it may be where they're living and all that they're not allowed to, or whatever the case may be, but it's because of the virus. And that's what Dennis is saying. We don't judge because we made that agreement. We can't say that they're sinning. We can't say that they're forsaking the assembly. We're not able to come to that point. Now, the only thing that's happened that has caused us to revisit this, as far as I understand, which would be maybe new members coming in, which is certainly understandable because they didn't have that, they didn't have the benefit of what we had discussed at length for hours previous. And then secondly, time has passed. So we were thinking it's going to be 2 or 3 months. Now it's been almost a year. And brethren have not been coming. But it's for the exact same reason. And we had determined already that we cannot say that's a forsaking the assembly of ourselves together. If there's anybody that And it's not giving carte blanche to anybody in the sense of okay, it's all right for you to forsake the assembly now, or it's all right for you to sin now, and we're not going to address it, we're not going to deal with you because of it. No, you deal with sin. We had that agreement that we couldn't come to that understanding that this was sin on the part of those who are staying home because of their fear of the virus and their health. That's the agreement we came to as a congregation, which led to everything else that we've discussed since then. And I think it's important that we remember that. Those brethren who are at home are very much discouraged right now because it's been 11 months since they've been with us. And when I think about, there are many of them, and when I think about the ones and why they're not here and why they're not able to come and they're not coming, then every single one of them has told me, and I've discussed it, I've tried to encourage them, I've tried to do whatever I can to enable them to come, if possible, to explain what we're trying to do, the mitigating circumstances. And they are concerned enough about their health and welfare from this that they say, I can't come right now. I'm hoping to come, want to come, but I can't come right now. Hopefully soon, but not right now. And because we made that agreement, then I'm sticking with that agreement. That's the point. And I mean, there have been little flare-ups with regard to this for the entirety of the 11 months. And it's not changed anybody's mind. It's not done any good. But again, it all goes back to the fact that we understood that we're not Solomon. And in this particular instance, tried to discern whether or not someone in their mind is not being honest in regard to this. Circumstances that we have accepted are just circumstances for not coming to services. And I can give examples to where there are other members of our congregation who have not come for a particular reason that I would never say is acceptable in my own heart. I can't do that. But I'm not going to judge them. It's been considered legitimate by the majority of the congregation, the majority of Christians, all of those kinds of things. Just because I can't do it, I can't say they're sinning. And so I'm not going to admonish them. When we're talking about it from the pulpit and we're dealing with it, if you're dealing with it, thinking about those brethren, they need to hear this. They've already heard it 1,000 times. They're thinking of it. And if they're just at all, and I believe that they are, I trust my brethren who are at home that they want to be here. And other than one or two, they've shown their willingness and desire to be here. And it's tearing them up that they can't be here. And so in those cases, I'm not going to say things to discourage them. I'm going to try to encourage them in that regard. And I don't think that that's not preaching the whole counsel of God or censoring ourselves at all. I just think that what we're talking about are individuals who we have agreed they're not forsaking the assembly in this case, if this is the case, and this is what they say is happening. And in that case, we're not to argue with them about it.
So, I want to add on to that. I'm not behaving the way I am towards any of the topics because of an agreement we made. I think that we made a good agreement, and the reason I think we made a good agreement is because the agreement is really just saying exactly what Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians 8 said, which is that when it comes to matters of conscience, that there's a certain way that the stronger and the weaker are to deal with one another. And so I can't go as far as what Josh Cox said a second ago about let's not bring up coronavirus at all, because of what I said before, where I don't think it's wrong to mention that we should re-examine ourselves from time to time about the coronavirus or about anything else. But when you go and you judge the heart in a way that you are incapable of knowing or perceiving, then that's inappropriate. For you to go to somebody and ask them to, or for you to even go one-on-one and say, hey, I want you to know that this is what this looks like. It would help me if you could help me understand it better. You know, going to someone one-on-one, then that's fine. But something that Stan said is very important. I mentioned before that if you're going up there and you're saying, we can't let this be an excuse, you know, where really I just make something up. We went to Topgolf, but we wouldn't go to services, you know, something like that. we can't be dishonest with ourselves like that. To bring that up and ask people to continually examine themselves, and maybe things change as they get vaccines or whatever in the world, is appropriate. But going and saying, hey, you're doing this as an excuse, even though I've got no physical evidence you've done anything else that would be analogous in some other part of your life, you're using this as an excuse. We've got a really big building, and you could be off in the corner and that like that. And I don't think anyone's done that, right? I don't think a single person has done that. And there's a spectrum between those two points. And at some point, you're judging the heart in a way that, A, you either can't do, just because you can't read someone's mind, or B, in a way that we're told not to do in 1 Corinthians 8 and Romans 14, where you're going to end up hurting the person. You're going to tempt them to eat meat when it would be wrong for them to eat meat. Right? That's the idea. And there are people, and this is something Stan said a second ago, there are people that have perceived that. Whether or not it's happened or not, they have felt attacked from the pulpit. That's why the topic came up. They felt attacked. They feel they're correct. They're at home. That's what they believe God wants them to be doing right now, because that is the best stewardship of their life, to be the best servants of God they can be. But they felt attacked. And I've had people come to me in the moment. I've had people message me on Facebook while watching someone talk from the pulpit that they felt attacked there. In that moment, they felt attacked. And I knew exactly what they were talking about. And I was on Facebook, so obviously I was at home at that moment. And I didn't feel attacked. And I didn't feel they were being attacked. But they felt attacked. And I wish it were true that everyone felt as, I don't know, comfortable, uninhibited as I do, to where had I felt attacked, I would go right to the person and be like, hey, you said this, and I think you crossed the line. But some people don't feel that comfortable. I've had Stan come up to me and tell me that there was someone in the parking lot crying in their car who should have just come up and talked to me. But when Stan told me they were crying in their car, I went out to their car and I talked to them. Because if you know your brother has aught against you, you lay down your sacrifice and you go to them. I'm not trying to hold myself up as holier than thou or something. It's just an example. But some people are going to be like that. Some people are going to go cry in the parking lot and not come talk to you. So that's why that's all I'm asking for, is for people to try. And God knows I'm lousy at it. I'm lousy at imagining how other people feel when I say so. I might be ticking some of y'all off right now. I don't even know. I don't know. But just trying to think about that as best you can, and then do as best you can, because we can't ask you to do better than as best you can. And then everyone on every side of it, except with love, people coming to you about being home, about what you say from the pulpit, about anything, except with love, that they're coming to you from love.
One last point. Tolerant tests work both ways. If we have to tolerate someone's decision to stay home, then they need to tolerate the decision of us talking about that. That's the way it works. That doesn't mean that the subject is necessarily directed at any one particular person. But in the case of eating of meats, if I was a Gentile and I thought it was perfectly capable of, I was perfectly allowed to eat meats in the new law, and I was trying to implore my Jewish brethren that is perfectly lawful, it would be in the realm of opinion to offer that encouragement for them to see the bigger picture. That doesn't mean that I'm taking that particular person aside and saying, hey, you're wrong, and I believe you're in sin, based on my judgment. But that doesn't also prevent me from speaking my opinion. Isn't that how we grow? Isn't that how we discuss things and learn how we're supposed to stand on certain subjects? To say that we can't talk about something, I believe, is a very slippery slope.
That's not what we're saying. What you have to understand, Rick, is what the direction that I've referred to is taken specifically from Romans 14:1, wherein the stronger Christian is said not to dispute with the weaker Christian on that particular subject because it's a matter of no consequence toward God. Not talking about sin. We're not talking about admonishing people in sin or encouraging people not to sin or for people to think about whether they are sinning. We're simply saying that in this particular instance, when we've got scruples concerning a particular situation, we've come to the conclusion in our discussions, and I think that last month, we came to that same conclusion over again, that we're not saying that any particular person is forsaking the assembly and sinning because they're not here as a result of the virus. And in that kind of situation, we're not to argue with them over it. And just if you're going to take it from that perception, if this feeling about it is not so much that they're upset or discouraged, but rather it causes them to doubt. In other words, I'm sitting at home thinking that I'm supposed to be doing right. Now my brother is telling me that I'm wrong by staying home. Am I? And you stay home and you violate your conscience in staying home, then you're leading an individual to sin. That's specifically what's involved in there. Now, I'm not saying that that's something that has happened in this particular circumstance. I'm saying there's a reason why Paul said in Romans 14:1, no, you don't dispute that. I remember Don Patton, whenever this Romans 14 thing came up, he said, I'm not going to judge him. He said, I'm going to put my arm around him. I'm going to tell him he's wrong. I'm going to tell him he's wrong. I'm going to tell him he's wrong. But I'm not going to take him out of the church. Well, he was saying what he was going to do is by talking with him and trying to show him where he's wrong, that he was fulfilling God's command. But Romans 14:1, that's exactly opposite. It's not a matter of declaring the counsel of God, of admonishing sin, of convicting brethren's hearts. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It's a matter of perceiving the impact of your comments upon a brother or sister in Christ and how that those comments can be construed as hurtful to them when we have, at this point in time, not come to an agreement that anything is wrong. That's discouragement. If you tell someone that they're not doing wrong, but then you go up there and tell them, you need to be examining yourself to see whether or not your heart is right in this particular matter, can you understand how that would be perceived as something discouraging to them? It's like it's a different thing. In everything, we've got to examine our hearts to make sure that our heart is right in this matter. And we understand that, and we preach on that and teach on that in principle, certainly. All I'm saying is that, for one, this is a moot point. The brethren who are not here for a good reason. And we've recognized it to be a good reason, so let's just make sure that we don't say anything that will inadvertently discourage them. It's not that hard in that regard. And I'm not saying not to preach the whole counsel or to compromise our convictions in any regard. If someone is in sin, tell them they're in sin. That's what we always have to do. You always deal with sin. Always deal with sin. But in this situation, none of us has said it's sin. What, you not understand that, Josh? I mean, when we talk about it...
You keep contradicting yourself.
What am I saying contradictory? We're not talking about a sinful action. This is not forsaking the assembly. It's a consistent message that I'm using here. Put it in Romans 14 if it belongs in Romans 14. If it's in Romans 14, Romans 14:1 says not to dispute about it. It gives us instructions between one another.
How many commands of God fall into Romans 14?
Things that are of insignificant to God, they are not sinful things.
Okay, let me ask you this. Is it insignificant to God whether or not brothers edify one another?
That's not the point. We're talking about the issue of sin. That's what Romans 14 is talking about specifically.
Is it insignificant? Does God not care that we do not edify one another? Does God not care that we do not that we do not sing songs of praise to one another, teaching and admonishing one another? Does God not care that we provoke one another to love and good works?
Well, let me ask you this, Josh. Are you saying that by extension of my argument that I just made, that I'm saying that God doesn't care? That I'm saying that God doesn't care? Because it's obvious that God cares about all of that. Let me give you a parallel so you understand what I am saying. This will help you understand what I'm saying. When this discussion with regard to what Romans 14 teaches was made with Bob Owens and others, the point that was made when we said these are matters of no consequence to God, they're matters of authorized liberty, matters of indifference is a term that is used. This is the answer. Nothing is a matter of indifference toward God. He cares even the hairs on your head, how they're numbered. And that is true, but that's not the point that's being made in the text and not the point being made when we say matters of indifference. We're talking about a specific issue. The issues under consideration, eating meats, observance of dates. The issue under consideration here is whether or not it's forsaking the assembly to miss the assembly because of the COVID pandemic. And when we made our decision way back 11 months ago as the men of the congregation, you may not agree with it, but you didn't speak up saying you disagreed.
I did.
Josh, last month you agreed with this.
No, I didn't. This is what you were saying. I certainly didn't.
Okay, well, this is the basis of the decision that we made as the men of the congregation. And it was one that, if you look it back at it, you would listen to the tape, go ahead and do it, whatever. But there was no indication that there was anyone who disagreed that would not follow this particular recommendation that was given. Since we cannot say it's a matter of sin, then we're not going to judge one another on that. And as a consequence of that, that it's not forsaking the assembly.
So who gets to decide a thing? Who gets to decide?
When we discussed it, Josh, there was no one in the number who said, I disagree with your statement that this is not forsaking the assembly. I think it is.
That's the whole matter of judgment that we talk
about. I don't think that the Matneys are forsaking the assembly. I don't think the Holts are forsaking the assembly. I don't think that the others that are under consideration at this particular time are forsaking the assembly because of the reason why they are there. And since they aren't forsaking the assembly, then I am not going to dispute with them as if they were sinning because it is a matter of indifference toward God. The fact that Romans 14 deals with matters of indifference doesn't mean this falls in Romans 14. We've got to come to that decision as to whether it's a Romans 14 matter. The men, as a consensus, and I thought it was completely and totally unanimous at the time, had come to that decision that this was not a matter of sin, that these individuals were not forsaking the assembly. And so as a result of that, if that is the case, then it falls directly in Romans 14, where I don't judge you, and you don't condemn me, and we don't argue about it. That's what Romans 14 is about, those kinds of issues. And that's why Dennis is saying, have we all of a sudden changed our mind with regard to whether or not this is the case? And I don't know that anyone has changed their mind in regard to it as far as me.
I've not wavered in my position. And my understanding at the very first meeting before it just became de facto for everything was that we could hold a Bible study online for Wednesday. But it was my full understanding at the first of all of this that nobody would miss assembly on Sunday. And then now it's become de facto everybody can do what everybody wishes to do because it's all open to the church.
Josh, it's such a misrepresentation of what we're saying. Everybody can do whatever they want. No, that's not what we're saying. No one can forsake the assembly. No one is allowed before God. Before God, no one is allowed to forsake the assembly.
What that is?
What?
Hey, Josh, my arm's tired. Put me third in line.
Just please understand that. No one will come to a different conclusion as to whether it is forsaking the assembly or not. But that was what was covered at that particular time. And that's the reason this dispute is as it is. Because those of us who you may think are saying, do whatever you want, carte blanche and everything, we're saying this specific thing that those brethren who are at home right now, they want to be here, they feel they can't be here because of the COVID virus, that they are not forsaking the assembly, hence they are not sinning, hence I'm not going to be discouraging to them by disputing with them about that. If I felt that they were forsaking the assembly, then when we had this discussion way back when, I would say, wait a second, brethren, we can't just allow people to sin and do nothing about it. I never have believed that, don't believe it now, and I will never believe that it's all right. I've always said, you deal with sin. You deal with sin. Those brethren aren't sinning. Those brethren I'm seeking to encourage. And because they're not sinning, I'm not going to say anything from the pulpit that would lead them to believe that I think that they are sinning, because that would be a discouragement.
Let's say, for the sake of argument, that you get to choose the definition of what forsaking is for yourself. Why can I not expect from my brother to love me, to come and edify me, the same as all of us should? Because that's why we're all here. I'm here to edify you guys. You guys should be here to edify me. Why can I not expect that out of my brothers? A second point. Rick alluded to this earlier. Romans 14, there is a weaker and a stronger brother over something that is of opinion. But the thing about that is, we're all supposed to grow. And if I am encouraging my brothers and sisters to grow, then there is nothing absolutely wrong with that. Nothing.
You understand that in Romans 14, if we put this in that scenario, that you're the weaker brother and I'm the stronger brother?
I don't know how you get to that.
Okay, well, I'll explain how you get to it. Because the weaker brother is the one who, as a matter of conscience, they cannot do something or they must do something. Whereas the stronger brother is the one who has the understanding that this is a matter of indifference. When you look at Romans 14, the matter of indifference is understood as a matter of indifference by the stronger brother. That this is not a matter of sin. The strong brother knows you can't eat meat. The strong brother knows you can observe the day. The weaker brother doesn't. Okay? That's the scenario. Okay, so in this case, the liberty that's under consideration is the liberty to stay at home without sin. You can't do that. You've made that clear. You can't do that. These brethren can. So with that in mind,
Your whole argument about these brethren is that they're so clutched and gripped by fear that they cannot assemble with the brethren.
No, what I'm arguing from, and I understand their fear and that it's present, what I'm arguing from is the fact that when they stay at home, that they have the liberty that is authorized by God to stay at home, and they recognize that liberty because of the circumstances, just as we would have the liberty not to come on icy roads because we understand the circumstances. Okay? Now this, no, it's a parallel. I just want you to understand this.
Apples and oranges. There's nothing preventing. There's no physical blockade preventing anyone from walking through.
That's the view that you hold, but that's the parallel that they are using. If you don't want to
go, it's improper.
Josh, then why wouldn't your family at the
last
service?
Get this understanding. If you feel that it is
very,
again, it's a consistency thing.
That's apples and oranges. I am consistent.
Okay, so
you're missing the point, though, Josh, that I'm making. I've got to fix this point, and then I'll stop. The point is this. Because you can't in good conscience stay home, okay? If we're not talking about how this is sin, okay? We're talking about it belongs in Romans 14. I'm just talking about how we deal with it. In Romans chapter 14, because of that, you don't recognize that it's sin. It's not that the weak brother doesn't recognize that, because he thinks it is sin. He's got that pain of conscience. So what is your responsibility as a weak brother? What's my responsibility as a strong brother? My responsibility is not to behave contentiously towards you. Okay? Because I can practice something or I can engage in something you can't in good conscience do. Your responsibility, if it falls into Romans 14, is not to judge a brother. That's the weak brother's responsibility in that. If you're going to put this particular circumstance in Romans 14, then of necessity, you're the weak brother because you're the one that cannot exercise.
I don't put this in Romans 14. You put it
okay.
in Romans
right.
14.
And that's what
we did. We did. In the meeting we had made that agreement.
Yeah.
I have constantly said, I cannot say
what we
this.
What feel percent. Is that I think everybody, and if I'm wrong, tell me, but I know I was under the impression that you did put this in Romans 14. Okay, so you don't because forsaking an assembly, correct? We're not to forsake the assembly.
Well,
we're also not supposed
to be gripped by fear. We're supposed to edify our brothers and sisters. We're supposed to sing songs, teach and admonish them. We're supposed to greet them. All of the above.
Right, but all
the Bible.
Exactly.
This is what I believe.
I understand that, but they're not doing those things, and in doing that, they're forsaking
the assembly.
Here's the slippery slope that I think that both sides have a leg to stand on, to so to speak. And this is where I see the opinion and why it's an opinion and not a matter of doctrine. If I have the flu, if I have a contagious ailment or something like that, I stay home not because I'm forsaking the assembly, but because I don't want to give that to any one of my brethren out of love.
Right.
I am doing something out of respect and out of love for my brother and sister. No one would condemn me for staying home when I have a fever.
Some would, but go on.
Well, the other side of that coin is, am I staying home? Okay, so with COVID, the problem was you didn't know whether you had it or not. And so there are some that would say, well, I don't know if I have it, so I want to stay home in case if I do, I don't want to give it to someone else. The other side of that coin is well, if I do have it, I obviously don't want to give it to anybody. Or I could get it when I go. Now, that's when we have the object of fear. What am I actually fearing? Am I fearing my physical well-being, or am I fearing the soul of somebody else, or the physical well-being of somebody else? That's where I think both sides have an argument to be placed. However, just as in the same exact situation with the eating of meats and not, there is going to be a discussion. That doesn't mean we dispute about it to say, well, you're wrong and I'm right. That's what's being condemned in Romans 14:1. That doesn't mean that discussions weren't made, because we all have basically the understanding now that meats are irrelevant. So how does that work with COVID? Or how does that work with any ailment? Because if I'm allowed to stay at home because of any ailment whatsoever, then this would fall into that category. The problem is whether or not you have it. And whether or not you're allowing the fear of that to drive your decisions rather than the fear of obeying God. Some people put it in different categories. So,
well, and that goes back to what Dennis was saying in that question. The discussion, from understanding, shouldn't take place from the pulpit, which it can't, I mean, because it's a one-way street, and we're saying that when those points have been brought up from the one side, the one position, it's caused some problems.
Opinions need to be given no matter where they're coming from. If they're wrong, they need to be addressed. But to say that we can't offer our opinion or our perspective on the situation is wrong.
Or to teach from
we
the
can't
word.
Do that.
No way saying that, Josh. You keep taking hyperbole and it's not helping. I'm sorry.
That we cannot particularly talk about COVID and use it as an application for anything, I would feel would be an over it would be an overuse of authority that we don't have. Because we want the preacher to preach his position and his opinion on things, and when we differ from that opinion, we talk to them about it. That's the way life goes. We don't all know the truth exactly perfectly. That's why we have different people speak.
Yes.
So, there is a difference between going to someone one-on-one and talking from the pulpit. That's important. It makes it easier for miscommunications to go unnoticed. If I'm talking to somebody one-on-one and they make a facial expression that does not match what I thought I was saying, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, what do you think I just said? You know? Whereas when I'm talking to everyone, or especially if I'm talking into a camera and can't even see the other person, then I'm not going to be able to catch that. It's one of the reasons I like to teach class more than preach, because I can get that immediate feedback to correct myself in places not where I'm wrong, but where I've accidentally allowed misunderstanding to happen. The situation we're talking about is people feeling like they're being attacked. It's not hard to understand. If you've got a situation, I'm gonna hit the nail right on the head. See how that goes. The other day, Josh Jackson had a kid that was sick. And they kept everyone home, because that kid that had a fever now had just been in a bathtub with two other kids, and the odds that they got it was pretty high. If I were to go up in the pulpit at that time and I were to say, You know, if you've got a sick kid at home and you use that as an excuse to keep everyone home because, hey, I've got my out where I don't have to go, rather than making a careful consideration and thinking to myself, well, what is the likelihood they're sick? What is the likelihood they'll get other people sick? Then you've sinned. If I got up in the pulpit and said that, even if Josh was at home, it's like, I did make the careful calculation to figure out this, thus, and such, and I did do the thing that I thought was best for the kingdom of God, you might still feel attacked. Because I'm sitting there while you're doing something exactly like what I'm bringing up from the pulpit. A, I might not have even known it happened, right? You might have felt attacked, and I was completely ignorant of the situation. It's an example I'd written up in my notes a month before. But you might feel attacked. That's the biggest thing I'm worried about, is those misunderstandings. Because the fact of the matter is, it's judgments. You make judgments all the time. I make judgments all the time about my own health, my kids' health, whether I'm coming. You know, when the kids were littler, we can kind of leave them home alone now. But when the kids were littler and one of them got a fever, the discussion was, well, who's going to go in the morning, who's going to go in the evening, right? Trickier now with everything being lumped in the beginning of the day. But that was the discussion. And the discussion that Bonnie and I had was this thoughtful discussion about what serves the kingdom best, right? Obviously, if I was leading singing or something, then I would need to go in the morning. You know, when I was leading singing, she could go in the evening. I could get someone to cover in the evening. Or if she was teaching class, then she would have gone in the morning and I would have gone in the evening. Something like that. But it was a judgment. It was a judgment that I couldn't leave my 6-year-old home alone, even though it probably would have been fine if I did. It was a judgment about who would go when, and sometimes one of us went to both the morning and the evening, and the other stayed home, depending on the circumstance. But it was a judgment. Both of the cases, so we have to ask ourselves in this circumstance, even though, by the way, coronavirus is completely a side topic of this conversation, because it's just the judgment of whether you can come. Coronavirus just happens to be a topic. But when we talk about the fear, that's a relevant thing. And it's a relevant thing to bring up, what would people be afraid of? There easily could be someone who's staying home because of conscience who's not afraid of anything. They've just made the calculated decision and says that's the best thing to do. I'm not afraid at all. There could be someone that's afraid of death. There could be someone that's afraid they won't get to be the best servant of God they can be if they die earlier, and they want to live longer, to be in His service longer here on earth. There are different possibilities. And without judging the heart, you know, what do you know? Without talking to the person so the person can reveal their heart, what do you know? But then people are feeling attacked, even though I don't believe they've been being attacked. But I do want to say this. I mentioned before there was a spectrum. You've got the examine yourself side of the spectrum. You've got the you're sinning right now, you're in danger of hellfire side of the spectrum. And you've got points in between. The three times I was messaged where somebody felt attacked or felt someone had crossed over the line was because they weren't merely saying, examine yourself. They had gone further on the spectrum to say something more than that. To either say, you are misexamining yourself, or even to say, you are in fear and that fear is a sin. Right? That's the states where they felt attacked. Now, somebody who had just made the logical decision, well, you know, logic can be wrong. I won't say logical. The reasoned decision, trying to use the best of their understanding and wisdom, and came to the conclusion to stay home, and somebody else said, you're in fear, and that's a sin, and they know good and well they're not in fear, might still feel attacked, even though they weren't in fear at all.
Josh?
Yes.
This is a great discussion, as long as everybody's comfortable staying and we're doing some good. I think it's good, any discussion is good. I just want to bring something to your awareness so that you are aware. The situation, what we're talking about is one side, not the other. Okay? And that's okay for now. But what we're talking about is concerns about those who may or may not be forsaking this symptom, and the fact that has only a symptom. Okay? My guess is that there's probably not any brother or family in this congregation that's considering leaving this congregation because there are people staying at home. But I know there are families that are considering leaving because of unwillingness to wear masks and socially distance. I've reconsidered our decision on this, and I understand that we never require anyone to wear a mask. In fact, Stan's article, Recent Bulletin, raises the question if we have a right to require anything, you know, of anybody here other than righteousness. So, we don't want to cause a problem with the brother that's not following the lead of the congregation. Okay? Or we're violating the love for one another. And when you see, I've rethought all this, and I've come to the understanding that the agreement we had to do with the 3-hour Sunday morning service. Okay? And I was under the delusion that we had also agreed to require the men to go when they were in the pulpit to wear the mask unless they were teaching and preaching. We didn't require them. We asked them, just like we asked everybody coming in to wear the mask. We also gave them an out, just like we gave what we've been talking about for an hour. And that out is, for whatever reason, if you feel like you have a hardship wearing the mask in the assembly, you don't have to wear it. Okay? We're asking you to do it. But if it's a real, and what we're doing is we're not judging your motivation. We're assuming that the reason you're not wearing a mask is because it's a true hardship. Yvonne will tell you. She can't breathe. There's something about the mask. So yeah, we're fine with that. But when most of the men are getting in the pulpit, right, and they're wearing a mask, and you decide, well, you're not going to. You're going to go up there, and you're not going to wear the mask, and you're going to do whatever business you have to do at the pulpit. Or like last night, I think maybe one Sunday to wear a mask. That's what I was told. I don't know if that was the accurate number or not. But what that communicates also, don't let the overlook the fact, what that communicates to some is that you really don't care enough about us enough to wear a mask. Situation there is, that's just a feeling. No one's judging you for not wearing a mask, but that's how they feel. And we don't want them to feel like we don't care for them or we don't love them. We may think there is no need to wear the mask, and you know what? There actually may not be a need. If I'm talking to you 3 feet face to face, I think we ought to be wearing a mask. But in the pulpit, maybe that's really debatable. You don't want someone to leave or count or something like that. Okay. But as far as this question, we need to move on. All this question is about is, Rick a while ago was making analogies. The analogy is, if you want to get in the pulpit and preach about forsaking assembly, I want to get in the pulpit and preach about not loving your brother and not submitting to them when they ask you to wear a mask. See, I'm not going to do that. Regardless of what you do. Because I don't want to judge you. The reasons why you're not wearing a mask. And I've agreed not to do that. That's true enough. And I think if we did that, we'd have an all-out war.
Yeah, no,
we
I agree. That, I agree that both sides, that's a parallel to both sides.
But if you don't want me to do that, but I don't want you to do that, let's just don't do it. And we'll skip question 3. If we can agree to that much, I think we can skip question 3. And 4 is a no-brainer. Let's do what we're doing now. If we have a problem with any decision we've made in the past, let's don't try it in the pulpit. Let's try it in the future. So we agreed on those two things.
What were 3 and 4 again?
We skipped 3.
Well, he's asking for clarity on what the question that we're skipping is.
Yeah, 3 is if
if we don't agree on 2.
If somebody goes ahead and gets up there, should we do something about that? What can we do?
So many issues are going to be created when we assume the intent or message behind the other person's actions. Assumptions are never good for anything, especially in regard to the mask. I am wearing a mask right now because there are some brethren that here are under the impression that it's safer for them to be a mask. It would make them feel more comfortable. Personally, I think it's actually the opposite. Scientifically, I think it shows the opposite. Is the case, but out of love and respect for that person, I wear the mask.
Why?
Do I do it all the time? No. Because I have personal issues with it. And so now I'm being asked to violate my conscience about the mask because of somebody else's situation. I will gladly do that because I would rather wear the mask than offend my brother. And I will gladly put my personal convictions aside for the sake of my other person, or for my other brother. That's what we're asking people to do here. But if that's going to violate their own conscience, they have the freedom and the right to do so. And I think so, that's what we're trying to get everybody to understand.
Right.
But let's be clear, though. Just talking about precision of speech, you don't actually mean you're violating your conscience by wearing the mask.
I believe masks are the opposite. They do the opposite effect.
I understand
they
that.
Create more of a... scientifically, medically wrong, or medically
they make you more likely to get back.
More likely to get the virus with the mask than without.
But what I'm saying is, you're not violating your conscience by doing it.
No, because it's indifferent with God whether I wear a mask. That's the point. Whether you wear a mask or not is indifferent with God, but forsaking the assembly is not.
Right.
Right.
And in Hebrews 10:25, why were they choosing not to assemble? Why?
It doesn't specify.
It does specify. It specifies exactly why.
It just is wrong to not submit to your brethren, not your brother.
Absolutely. But why were the brethren in Hebrews 10 forsaking the assembly? What was their choice? Why were they not assembling?
We don't know.
Fear of persecution.
No, we
That's
don't
exactly
know.
What it says in Hebrews 10.
It does not say that. We don't know what the reason was.
Can I say something real quick? I'm sorry. Not to interrupt the conversation, but I love everybody here, and I'm not upset about our meeting. It's good. I just have kids that are in the car right now.
I was in the car.
I'm going to go.
Okay,
but I'm
that's
not
fine.
Trying to avoid anything. Or,
no, that's fine.
And I'm okay with whatever we decide, one way or the other. So, I apologize.
The conclusion that is drawn from Hebrews 10 is that they were choosing to not assemble out of fear.
Is
whatever the fear
of,
was for.
Is, are you saying that because of, and so much the more as you see the day approaching would have reference to the coming
It would have
judgment.
Some reference to that. Let me open it up and look at it again so I can bring it to context.
This is interesting, but not germane.
Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another in so much more as you see the day approaching. The context indicates that they were the reason they were not assembling was they were not considering one another to stir up love and good works, and they were also not holding fast the confession of their hope. They were wavering. Why was their hope wavering? Why were they not assembling?
That's brought out the rest of the book.
And that's my point. The point is they were fearing the persecution of being killed for their faith.
don't know that, right? Context does not support that kind of wisdom.
Guys, that wait a second, please. I'm just asking. That there's a disagreement with regard to what the context allows, but let's not get upset, okay? I mean, we've had a spirited discussion, but please, let's not walk away upset, okay? Please, I'm begging you. And we've got a new brother in Christ here. We need to just make sure that we can do this in good conscience with pure hearts and love. And if we need to take a time off and all decide, let's just panel this for a while or let's talk privately. Just please.
Then let me pose the question this way. If I thought for 1 minute that I would be killed for obeying Christ and that by showing up here, whoever showed up here would have a bullet put in their head, would I still show up?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And so would I.
And I think everybody here would. Because we're choosing to rather to serve our Lord the way He has asked us to do than let the fear of death or anything in between come between me and my Lord.
Amen.
And if I am going to let some virus keep me from worshiping the Lord the way I am asked to do, then that is coming between me and my Lord, and I need to reflect on that.
Let me ask you a question then, Rick, in this regard. It's a legitimate, I'm not trying to disagree with what you're saying, because I agree with you on that, okay? But in saying that, what we're saying then, let me ask you this question. Since the fear of death itself and the possibility of death itself is perhaps the most extreme of all those circumstances that would cause someone to miss, does that delegitimize individuals missing for other reasons that are perhaps even less extreme than that? Because it seems to me that most of the reasons why we've mentioned here and most of the reasons why we have ourselves in times past not come to services and not thought it to be forsaken would be less extreme than fear of persecution to the point of death.
My answer to that is basically this. Am I choosing to stay home because I fear death from this virus? If so, I probably need to reflect on that. However, if I'm staying home because I fear causing death to someone else, then I feel okay with that. That's why I think that right. there's that judgment call in this regard. Now, am I going to any particular individual, especially Dennis, am I going to any individual and saying, I believe you're in sin? No. Am I doing that by offering that perspective from the pulpit even? No. I am not calling a single person out. There is actually one person here that I don't believe is in compliance with this. Because I don't understand it. I don't see their reasoning behind it. But out of not wanting to judge that particular individual for their actions, I'm not doing anything about it because I don't feel it's that big of a deal. Now, can it become a big deal for that particular person? Absolutely.
Certainly.
So how do we address a problem that can cause such an issue without addressing the problem? If we don't ever talk about it, it never gets addressed. How do we not preach about something?
We do preach about it. We preach and we
ask. Dennis is asking that we do not talk about this subject.
We've had extensive discussions on this in the business meetings before you got here and now for 2 weeks or 2 months in regard to this and trying to deal with these kinds of things. Well, just understand this. I don't dispute the fact that I mean, I've on many occasions from the pulpit dealt with the coronavirus and the impact it's having. When it first started, just about every lesson I brought from the pulpit was in some way dealing with that because it impacted the brethren so extensively.
For like 6 months.
It's been 11 months since we started.
No, I'm saying every lesson for 6 months.
Well, maybe. Okay, so that's one point that I want to make. I wanted you to... there's a passage in 1 Thessalonians 3:1. It says, when we could no longer endure it, we thought it good to be left in Athens, and sent Timothy, our brother and minister and fellow laborer in the gospel, to establish you and encourage you concerning your faith, that no one should be shaken by these afflictions, for you yourselves know that we were appointed to this. For in fact, we told you before when we were with you, you would suffer tribulation, just as it happened, and you know. Okay, so this is the idea, encouragement. And we're not saying that these things should not be dealt with. What I am saying is that we need to be aware. It is our responsibility when we go to the pulpit to convict, to admonish, when all those different things, but also to encourage. And we do need to be mindful when we're preaching not to be a discouragement to brethren. That's a responsibility that Timothy as an evangelist had. Not, I'm not saying that they become discouraged because we're convicting them of sin. That's not the point.
We also don't need to not preach about something just because of how somebody feels about how that was being preached.
No, I understand.
You talked about trust in marriage today. We've had a problem with that in my marriage.
I understand.
Do I feel guilty because you talked about it today? Do I feel like you were attacking me? No. I'm not going to come to you and say, don't preach on that ever again. I'm going to take it as words of encouragement and hopefully learn from it.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
I'm not going to ask anybody to not preach about something that they're convicted on. If it's sin, I'm going to address the sin. I'm not going to tell them not to say something.
I don't disagree. If anything for this perception of what we've been talking about indicates that we're saying that sin shouldn't be dealt with, it's got to be a misunderstanding. If you're saying that we're inconsistent in dealing with sin, that's a different story. But my conviction has always been that these brethren are not sinning, which is why I deal with it the way I deal with it. And I was under the impression, even with regard to you, Rick, at least, from last month, that you're not charging anyone with being guilty of sin either. And you deal with sin. You always deal with sin. You can deal with sin from the pulpit. You can deal with sin anywhere. And I'm not disagreeing with that. I don't think that these brethren are in sin, or I would be dealing with it. But I don't think that they are. And as a result of that, I want to be sure that when they're under discouraging circumstances and the fact that they cannot be with us, that I do nothing to make them more discouraged. I want to encourage them and to strengthen them in that way.
I agree. And the best place to receive that encouragement
in an indirect way.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I wish that they could be here.
So back to where we began.
Well, but Josh, do you think they're in sin for not coming?
Yes, he does.
He's never actually said that.
Would you like me to say it now?
I would if that's what.
If
you
are staying at home because you fear that you will die because you came to worship, then yeah.
Okay. Well, then that's our disagreement.
Hey, Josh. The last few comments have been very interesting to me because it didn't even occur to me somebody might be staying home because of that. I've never once stayed home because of the flu or kept my kids home because of the flu because I thought they were going to die or that they were going to kill anyone else, nor with coronavirus. I'm actually far more likely to kill one of y'all than I am to die myself, just because of the average ages and immune systems and such, and the fact that I go to work and I'm around Australians and British people and get opportunity for all sorts of different viruses.
Those Australians.
But the thing is, that's interesting to me, and maybe that's why some people have felt more attacked, because they feel that way, because I did stay home at one point, because I had been in physical contact with someone who tested positive, and so I stayed home. I didn't stay home because I was afraid of killing someone. I wasn't worried about that. The same way I don't stay home when I have the flu because I'm worried about killing someone. I stay home when I have the flu because I'm worried that I might be impacting the health and well-being of people in a way that's detrimental to the kingdom. If I feel lousy, but I don't think I'm contagious, a lot of times I'll still come. Because I'm not worried about me feeling lousy, and I'm not worried about impacting someone else where they won't be able to be as good of a service. So that is interesting. I know that we talked a lot about fear, and maybe there are people that are home because of fear of dying. I hope not.
If they are, does it mean we can address address that?
Well, but I hope not. But the reason that I hope is because I have no knowledge, right? And so, that's back to what I was saying. I don't feel comfortable having coronavirus being just a forbidden topic. When we call each other to examine ourselves in any topic at all, or when we talk about don't fear or don't worry, you know, these are straight from the Bible. When we say don't worry about the thing that can kill your body, or the thing that can send your soul to hell, these are things that we can talk about all the time. But I can't say that anyone has fallen into the category that you just said, Josh, because I simply don't have the knowledge. I honestly did not consider that a single human was staying home because they were afraid of dying. That may just be naive on my part, right? Maybe they are. I don't know.
So why can I not preach on that? If that's not the case, why can I not preach on that?
The avenue that a pulpit provides is a way to indirectly address a topic without directly stepping on particular people's toes. We do this all the time in different ways.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think stepping on people's toes is wildly underrated. But the point is that if I had thought that anyone had sinned in the pulpit, I would have gone to them, right? When we said, if you're crippled by fear, that's a sin, and I say we said that because one of us said that, as far as I know, nobody went to the person and said, that's wrong, that's a sin, you should go up there and apologize and say that wasn't right. I'm like, yeah, we shouldn't be crippled by fear. I agree with that, rock on, moved on to the next thing. But other people felt attacked. That's all I keep coming back to. Should they have felt attacked? Probably not. I know at one point Sam was teaching on not forsaking the assembly about once every 6 Sundays for the course of about 16 months. I know people were feeling personally attacked then. Were some of them feeling personally attacked because they were wrong and they needed their conscience to be pricked? Yeah. Were some of them feeling personally attacked and they weren't wrong? They were just taking it the wrong way. Yeah. They were. I mean, that's the thing. And if I think anyone's sinning in the pulpit, I'm going to them. If I think anyone's sinning by staying home, I'm going to them. And absolutely everyone else should be doing the same.
Well, I motion that we in this discussion and encourage people to get together and study about it, especially those with differences. And, you know, like we said always, if you think your brother's in sin, we have a right and a duty to go to him. I think we all agree on that. And two, keep in mind, you know, what's the most beneficial for the kingdom? As, you know, Justin mentioned that earlier. In all things, we've got to take that into consideration. And of course, dealing with sin is always beneficial for the kingdom. It is. But in these matters where there are judgments, then we need to consider that. What's best for the kingdom. And so I'll leave you with that. And we will pick up next week. The next one's going to be quicker because this one came in the 20th. I don't know what the dates of March are, but...
You got that other topic.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you want to bring that up real quick? Wait.
Well, so...
You're fine with waiting until next time, Nick?
Do you want to give us something to think? Well, wait a minute. Let me real quick on that. So, I don't have a topic for the next Adult Wednesday class series. I was thinking about doing expediences and conscience and practical application. And the Lord, yeah, there's some meat. Get ready. Bring your steak knife. the Lord's Supper is a topic on that. And it's broader than what you were bringing up, right? It talks about multiple times a day, separate rooms, everything, you know, whatever. But I could go ahead and address it in a Wednesday night class. But I wasn't sure if that's what you were talking about, or if you were saying there needed to be a more focused study on it.
I think we as a congregation need to study this, because there's a differing of opinion amongst the churches around the world about this particular issue. And COVID really has brought this to the surface, because people were closing their doors, and it has forced congregations to make stances on observance of the Lord's Supper. Whether or not they're right or wrong, everybody's making different choices. But why? What I want to drive at is what should we do? What is our stance on as a congregation? I know I have my personal stance that I'm not going to impose on anybody, because I believe it's a matter of judgment. But at the same time, I also understand that when somebody else has a particular position, and so the whole thing that brought this up was Kyle Austin and their family were here. Okay, I absolutely know exactly where he stands on this issue. He believes that we can only partake of the Lord's Supper in a called assembly in a local established church, and when doing so, that we are to wait for one another. Those are his understandings, which I, for the most part, agree with that. I have some disagreements with some of it, but the fact that he, and I know where he stands on this, he believes that, he was put in a situation that conflicted his conscience. Now, he hasn't voiced that to me, I'm not fighting for him, but I know where he stands on the situation. The problem begins by saying, okay, well, we've already partaken this morning, so you're here. If it doesn't violate your conscience, go ahead and take it, when nobody else was waiting at that time for them to partake and proclaim. So either we were in violation for not waiting for them while they partook, or they were in violation for partaking when we weren't waiting for them.
The only problem I had with that is if we were in violation, then in that situation, there was absolutely no way for us to prevent it, because we had no idea they were coming.
And to that, I agree.
That's not exactly what he's saying. He's saying if they went off into another room and took it while we're all here.
Which they didn't. They actually took it while in the pew while we were in the middle of the second hour of service. That presents a problem. And I think we all agree with that. Because now, they're partaking in the middle of a worship assembly, and they're doing something that not everybody else is doing. They're not waiting for one another, just like we weren't waiting for them. So it's a double-edged sword. That's why I have a problem with this. I believe it's I absolutely believe it's sin.
So the reason I wanted to go ahead and bring it up is because I wrote the lessons like 15 years ago. I want to go back and polish them and you know, and make them better. But it's a meaty topic, right? It's talking about the Lord's Supper. It's talking about women speaking in class. It's talking about money. Money's always a touchy topic. It's talking about things like that. And I wanted to broach that with the men before I went and got all these lessons ready.
I would like to offer just one thing for everybody to kind of research before we reconvene next month on this particular issue. It'll only take a couple of minutes to walk through real quick, but I have it written out, so I can come up there.
Could I suggest a study together rather than having it as a part of the men's meeting?
Sure. Absolutely.
I think that would be more appropriate.
Well, my question was just, does anyone want me to not bring such a meaty set of lessons?
I have no problem with meaty lessons. We just got to do a better job of being nice and discussing and not getting upset at one another. That's what I would say. So,
yep. And that's the thing.
Can you make everybody be nice to each other?
We spend 6 weeks on Lord's Supper.
And just remember patience, brethren, because, you know, we disagree, but we need to have unity, but we don't have to have unity this second, and, you know, the Lord allows time to work through stuff.
I'm not looking at us coming together and saying, oh, well, we all believe this one thing next week, you know.
Right. But no, that'd be something to do.
it's a matter of perspective. It's going to take some time to really discuss this. And yes, we do need to sit down and have a study with it.
And I don't know that the business meeting is necessarily the best place for it.
I don't know, but y'all, I'm hungry. I'm always hungry. But if y'all give me 5 minutes, and then I'll go.
Okay.
So food for thought on this particular issue. I know that we kind of touched it a little bit by saying that Kyle, I believe that Kyle was put in a predicament. He was either, do I partake because I know I'm supposed to partake, or do I not partake because nobody's waiting on me now? So that presented a problem. My personal stance on this particular issue is that it is an individual action. And I, Stan and I have discussed this at length at another point in time, but that is my stance on this. Now, it is an individual action done collectively when we are assembled, right? We have those examples for us in 1 Corinthians. It's the Lord's Supper is referred to as a Passover. It's not the Christian's Passover, but the Christ is being explained as our Passover, which is our sacrificial lamb that we partake of because His blood has cleansed us from our sin. Right? That was the whole point of the Passover in the original in Exodus 12, because they were being passed over from their sins and then being brought out of Egypt, right? So there's some comparisons, there's correlations there. The original occurrence of the Passover is obviously Exodus 12. The location that it was being taken of was actually their individual houses, right? We see that in verse 7. The whole assembly, though, look with me real quick, Exodus 12, verse 6. Exodus 12, verse 6. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. Now, it says the whole assembly here. Were they all in one house? No. They were in individual houses, but yet they were called the whole assembly. Okay? We have a reoccurrence of the command in verse 14. It shall be a memorial. It says this day, right? It's called a feast in verse 17. Now, we skip forward in time a little bit, and we have Numbers chapter 9. We have a situation where there were some that wanted to partake, but were actually unclean and unable to partake. And they were wanting to know what the course of action was for them to be able to partake. And so Numbers chapter 9, verse 2 beginning, let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. That's the command. But then because they had been defiled by a dead body, they were not able to partake. In verse 8, Moses said to them, stand still, I will hear what the Lord commands you concerning. Commands concerning you. And he says, speak to the children of Israel. If any one of you or your posterity is unclean because of a dead body or is far away on a journey, he may still keep the Lord's Passover. And then he provides a way of doing that. The second month, 14th day of the second month at twilight, they may keep it. So this is a second offering of the Passover. There are some in the church today around the world, and I don't know where anybody stands here. I'm just going to put that out. I don't know where anybody stands on any particular issue on this. But there are some that believe you cannot offer a second offering of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. This would kind of would show a principle to where it could be. I'm not saying that this is the law for the New Testament, but I can get shadows of things from the Old Testament to learn from, right? But here, God gives them a second opportunity to partake of the Lord's Passover. Then, quickly, I'm trying to go as quickly as I can because I know it's late. Again, the original location for partaking of the Lord's Supper was in individual homes. Okay, they were to kill the Passover lamb for that home and that family. Okay, none of it was to remain until morning. Now, the place actually begins to change in Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 2. Therefore you shall sacrifice the Passover of the Lord your God from the flock of the Lord in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name.
Okay? We're starting to see a change of location. And it's coming from God. Verse 5, you may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates. Now it becomes a problem of you're not even allowed to do it inside the gates. But at the place where the Lord your God chooses, verse 6. Roast it and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. And in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. So now we know that it's not in their current home that they're to be partaking this. Verse 7. Hezekiah commanded all Israel and Judah, Ephraim, and Manasseh to come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in 2 Chronicles 30 and verse 1. And to partake of it in the prescribed manner, verse 5. Ezekiel chapter 45 says that they put the blood on the doorposts of the temple. Before, in Exodus 12, it was the doorposts of the house, right? Now it's doorposts of the temple, verse 19. The next use of the word Passover is found in Matthew 26, where the disciples ask Jesus, where do you want to prepare for you to eat the Passover? Where did he partake of the Passover?
Upper room.
In an upper room, not in the temple. Is Jesus in violation of the Passover? Obviously not, because we know he didn't sin. But why is he not? That's at the heart of this issue. Some people believe that you are not allowed to partake of a second serving, or you're not allowed to partake even in your homes if you're not assembled. But these particular points that I'm trying to draw out here indicate that there could be another way of looking at this. And that's what I want to discuss. I'm not saying that we need to obviously dig into it now. It's 2 o'clock. I think it's 2 o'clock.
Yep.
And we've gone considerably long. So I appreciate your patience with me on that. But for a long time, I thought that when me and my wife or whoever were assembled in just two or three, and we were assembled in our home, that would constitute as an assembly we could partake. And then I sat down with someone that showed me that, wait a minute, there's really a different reason why we would do that, and let me explain to you why. And 6 months later, 6 weeks of intensive study, and then 6 months later, I'm sitting down with a lot of people on this particular situation and discussing it. And I actually changed my view on that. And I personally feel that if I were sick and I were unable to partake in the assembly, that I am still, as an individual Christian, obligated to partake. And the reason I say that is Jesus said, this do in remembrance of me. He didn't say that to the church. I mean, he does indirectly. But he says that to an individual. So when we come here as individuals, we are partaking individually. If you partake correctly and I partake incorrectly in the same building, does my incorrect worship or my incorrect partaking invalidate yours? No. Just like in singing, if I don't sing with the right heart, it doesn't invalidate your worship, and vice versa, right? My correct way of doing it doesn't validate your incorrect way, right? We all understand that. If I'm sick and I'm not able to get to worship and to the assembly of the saints, I still have an obligation to proclaim to myself, and this is where Stan and I differ, I can proclaim to myself that yes, I am still a child of God, I am still a member of God's family, and I am still putting that blood on the doorpost of my heart because he has passed over my sins. I can still do that to myself in my home. But I choose to do it amongst brethren because, one, we're called to assemble and to encourage one another to stir up love and good works. But also because we see examples of early Christians assembling for that particular purpose. Now, an example does not necessarily, let me underscore that word necessarily, exclude another way of doing things. For instance, if an example was binding and you could not do it any other way, then the model prayer or the example prayer that Christ gave would be the only prayer that we could offer. But that wasn't the intent behind the model prayer, the example prayer, right? The intent was to show them principles behind it, right? We don't pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, because it's already here, right? Things have changed. That doesn't mean the law has changed. It's just the underlying structure of it all has changed because now we have the full, complete word, and we see different things because the church is now instituted. On that note, though, in this last little point, look with me in John chapter 20. And this is more to prove that they were assembling than it is about partaking of the Lord's Supper, because I don't know whether or not they did. But in John chapter 20, the day Christ arose from the grave is the first day of the week. That's why it's so important to us as Christians to meet on Sunday, because that is the day that sticks out to us as the day, right? That is the day that Christ arose. Verse 19, the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled, for fear of the Jews. Now this would not be a sinful fear, because yes, they are given with fear, but they are fearing yet assembling. Jesus came and stood in the midst and then said to them, peace be to you. Now, why were they assembling aside from the Jews? It says for fear of the Jews, but why were they assembling? We don't know. It doesn't give us that in the context. However, a precedent is made when you look down a little bit further. Verse 26, after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and he stood in the midst of them. Why were they assembled 8 days later? Because it sets that precedence of assembling on the first day of the week. It says 8 days, but in the way the Jewish work their calendars, that's the next following first day of the week. All right. So already we have disciples of Christ. We can't call them Christians yet because they weren't given that name until Acts 11. But these were Christians. They were followers of Christ assembling on the first day of the week. Before Acts 2, where we had the establishment of the church, right? Or the quote unquote beginning. I've had somebody tell me that these people were not allowed to partake of the Lord's Supper because it was not the church. I don't know that I can go there. I've had people tell me that they don't believe that. The heart issue is a different thing. So if we're going on vacation and we're we're all in the same car, we're just going to worship in our car, or worship because we're going on vacation, that's a different issue. That's not what I'm trying to authorize or anything. I'm not trying to authorize anything. I'm trying to look at the word. But if I choose, like, say we were to all go on vacation as a congregation, because that was part of the, that was an example given by the last speaker I dealt with, that each summer they would all go, that most of the congregation would leave and they would go to this other area as a vacation. But because there were so many of them, they could have just said, well, why don't we just assemble and we can just worship here, and that would be wrong, and why? And they made the claim, well, they're not with the local congregation. And to that question, I was like, okay, well, then if I'm visiting somewhere, if I'm traveling to go somewhere, at what length do I have to search for a local congregation to partake of the Lord's Supper as commanded by God? Do I go 5 miles away from where I'm going to be staying? 500 miles? Where do I draw that barrier? And because of asking that question, it created a storm of problems, and to which I ended up having to leave the congregation because they were binding things that I felt were not biblically bindable. So I don't want us to get to that point. I don't want us to go that direction. But I did want to at least provide that information so that we can discuss it at another time. Because I want us to be able to consider the visitor that comes in or the member that may not have gotten here on time. Which, that's a whole different problem, and I understand that. I'm not trying to say we should bend because somebody can't plan. That's not my problem. But for instance, when Kyle and them came here, because we had it in the first hour, it presented a problem because he got here 2 minutes late and missed it. That presents an issue. In other congregations, what they've done is, well, we have a second offering in the evening or in the second hour worship that day. To allow them to fulfill and complete the command that God had given them. And we would wait for them during that time, so we're not doing anything else. But we're letting them focus and proclaim their covenant relationship with God, just like we are in that same situation. So, with all that said, I know that's a lot. please, by all means, I know there's probably going to be questions, and if you have any whatsoever, please call me. I will do whatever, and I will study with anyone for whatever length. I don't care, as long as there's food. So on that, I will end, and if you have anything, please get with me on that.